Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's a bit chilly out there this morning and I'm not just talking about the weather. The Queen is once more in the spotlight after the Sun this morning revealed that Mike Tyndall, the former rugby player and husband of Zara Phillips, has been claiming furlough money despite being worth more than 15 million quid and living on a 700-acre royal estate. As if Her Majesty hasn't had a bad enough year already with the revelations about Prince Andrew and the paedophile and the Harry and Meghan nonsense, here comes another spoiled and totally selfish member of the family doing something grubby and something rather greedy. You might not care about the royal family or even the minor members of it. Zara is, of course, the Queen's granddaughter, but you should care about wealthy individuals taking advantage of government schemes when others have been left bereft with nothing. It's a right royal scandal, as far as I'm concerned. 0344 499 1000. So I want to hear from some of you out there, many of you who have not had much help from the government. Some of you have. Some of you have been on furlough for most of the year. But many people, let's not forget, have been forgotten in this pandemic and haven't made any money whatsoever. So the cheek of somebody like Tyndall, who's worth millions and millions and millions, furloughing himself because he hasn't been able to make any after-dinner speeches. I mean, do me a favour, matey, will you? 0344 499 1000. Coming up this morning, we're kicking off with Trevor Kavanagh, who wrote this week that Boris Johnson wants to open things up, but he's been prevented from doing so by the sage advisers. And he's not too happy about it. Neither am I, by the way. We're also asking how it's possible that so many university academics are now the subject of investigation thanks to their links with China and various spy agencies. Quite an incredible story. 0344 499 1000. Founder of the New European, Matt Kelly, joins us too with news that the pro-Remain newspaper has got some new investment and is on the brink of expanding. And as ever, of course, we want to hear from you. If you've got any questions for our medical experts or simply if you have news for us on how hard it's been to get anything out of this government, then please do let us know. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, let us talk to a man who has a very interesting view about the sage advisers who are leading so many politicians down a garden path and not allowing them to climb over the fence into freedom. Trevor Kavanagh, a former political editor of The Sun, political columnist now at the newspaper. Trevor, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
I read with some interest your piece yesterday, Trevor, because it totally and utterly chimed with what I've been saying for a very long time, that these sage advisers, who we refer to as the scientists, many of them are not actually scientists at all, are they?
Not in the sense that this epidemic requires, anyway. They're not virus experts. They're academics, not medical experts.
Right, exactly right. And your claim, and I think it's probably backed up by the science, if you like, is that Boris Johnson... at heart, would like to lift this lockdown quicker than they would like him to. Where do you think that's all going, and how do you think he gets out from under their influence?
Well, as I understand it, he is held back by the advice of Sage on the number of deaths, and quite rightly in the sense that only a few weeks ago we were looking at about 1,800 a day dying. That was the maximum in January.
Yeah.
But that is coming down very rapidly thanks to the sensationally successful vaccine program and indeed the lockdown itself, I guess. So the numbers are now, according to the last couple of days' figures anyway, around 300 plus. So they're rapidly declining from that 1,800 figure to a much, much lower figure. Once they get to 100, they reckon people in government that I've spoken to believe that Boris will be hard-pressed and indeed doesn't really want to maintain the lockdown beyond the point of, say, 100 a day. Well, 100 a day is very bad news for the 100 who die, but for the economy and for the country, I think it's the point at which we have to let go.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, towards the end of last year, before this new variant came in on the 18th, I was always pointing out to people that the average number of deaths per day in this country on any given day, regardless of the pandemic, is about 1,600 anyway, you know, a week rather, a day. So in terms of like the numbers of people who are affected by this disease outside of COVID, in terms of the people suffering from the lockdown, who can't get furlough money, who can't open their restaurant, who can't go back to work, I mean, the damage there does not seem to even being looked at by the sage advisors.
No, and I think that you're right, that the number of excess deaths, which is everything over the average over the five-year period, is now basically running at that average. So one of the reasons for that is that there have been virtually no flu cases by comparison with previous years because of the lockdown, because all attention is focused on COVID. But there are members of the SAGE workforce who are really very dubious characters, in my opinion anyway, and not least of them is Neil Ferguson, who's now predicting that we could see another up to 167,000 deaths from this bug, when quite clearly the numbers are falling as fast as it's possible to imagine. There's also a woman named Susan Michie, who is not a virologist or in any way directly a medical expert. She's a behavioral scientist. She may have medical qualifications, but not directly in the field of this particular virus. Susan Michie is avowedly a communist. She's a member of the British Communist Party. And I think we've seen from some of the very extreme left-wing activists involved in British society, not least the National Education Union, that there are people who do not particularly want to see Boris Johnson have a good war. They're rather relishing the fact that this has been it's been a rough ride for Boris, to be frank. And now that there is a way out, which is clear and specific, they seem to be dragging their feet and putting up new objections about reasons why we shouldn't lift lockdown.
Well, that seems to be the trouble, doesn't it? I was watching Matt Hancock yesterday, and as he was revealing these figures, these statistics of, you know, 95% of the over 70s have now been vaccinated, he's now asking for people to get in touch if they haven't been contacted yet by the NHS to get the vaccine. I was waiting for the next part of the sentence almost to say, and as a result of that, we can now do this. But there was no second part of the sentence. So all of the talk last year about when we get the vaccine, that will be a game changer. We're still waiting for the game to change.
Indeed, and I think that it is changing regardless of what people's objections may be. We are seeing a fall in infections quite dramatically. We're seeing a fall in hospitalizations. And we're seeing, as I said, a very dramatic fall in the number of daily deaths. So we are getting to the point where Boris has set the date of February the 22nd for setting out a roadmap for some sort of recovery plan and return to normal. And he's also said that schools will return on March the 8th. Now, there's an enormous amount of pressure building within the Conservative Party and elsewhere, in every home in the land probably, for that to be brought forward to the end of the half-term holiday, which is a week or two earlier. And indeed, Scotland and Wales are already doing this for primary school children. I think the pressure is on Boris to accelerate that programme.
And what do you think is behind the SAGE advisers and their wish to continue with the lockdown? Do you think it's just that they quite like it? Do you think it's that they quite enjoy the kind of power? Or what do you think their psychology is?
Well, I wouldn't want to imply too many motives to the SAGE group, because quite clearly they would see themselves as being the moderators in a very complicated field, which is deciding as and when it's safe to lift the lockdown. But I think there is no doubt that there is, in some areas of our society, an actual relish of the fact that we're locked down, the fact that the government is pinned down, the fact that we are able to dictate to people. People, once they're given powers, as we've seen many times in recent months, love to impose them. And I think that there are many members of Parliament who are very worried about civil liberties and were very worried at the time that these emergency powers were effectively invoked at the beginning of the first lockdown. And they forecast exactly the situation, which is that people, once given powers to affect the lives of other people, will carry on using them long after their sell-by date. Mm.
Quite, because we seem to have given up altogether any kind of vestige of democracy or any kind of conversations in Parliament about the next stage, you know, because all of the things that we were told would happen, i.e. don't worry, there will be another debate before we impose any further lockdowns, you know, that seems to have gone by the wayside now.
Indeed, and I think that's another very serious subject, Mike. I think that the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, is resisting moves by various people, not least the Leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who has called for the full return of Parliament. But Lindsay Hoyle is digging his heels in because he has decided the risk is too great. And I think that as long as the Parliament is not sitting properly, and if necessary, why don't we give MPs the jab so that they can carry on as key workers? We are not seeing democracy being carried out in our national parliament.
No, we're certainly not. I had an idea last week. I don't know what you think of this. Is that if you need to stay at home because you've got some vulnerabilities and you're worried about going back to work as an MP, fine. But we should have a second tier payment system, which means that one, you get less money, like some poor people who are currently on furlough on 80% of their salary. You don't claim expenses, which many of them have been doing. I mean, I couldn't believe when I saw last week the numbers of front bench Labour MPs who were claiming all sorts of things, including first class rail travel up and down the country when we're supposed to be in a pandemic. I mean, it seems extraordinary to me that MPs will continue to insist on a lockdown, which doesn't affect them financially whatsoever.
No, it's amazing, really, how people's scruples. I mean, you've also got queue jumping by people who are not frontline workers and have no justification whatsoever for getting ahead of the vulnerable in the queue for vaccines. You've got the story that you mentioned earlier about Mike Tindall and the furlough scheme. Yeah. I think the furlough scheme is going to be looked back on as a huge funding for fraud.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that Mike Tindall is guilty of fraud, but I do think that someone who is worth about £15 million pounds and is the only employee, as far as I can see, or as far as the records show, is receiving furlough from the government. I think that there are a lot of people who are pushing this to the limit.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, it is always going to be the case that there will be fraud out there. And we've seen in some cases, some celebrities, I think Steve Coogan was one who furloughed his gardener, and Posh Spice was among them as well. Both of them, I think, reversed the decision when they realised somebody had found out about it. It wasn't as if their conscience had suddenly pricked them. But, you know, unfortunately, people who we now have a society which is split between those who can work from home very happily in their nice, airy front room or their nice airy study with a very nice new Apple Mac PowerBook, and those who have to actually physically go to work to get paid.
Yes, I think there are a lot of stories out there of deprivation, genuine deprivation and pressure and anxiety. People who have to work simply to keep the keep their body and soul together, really, but also at the same time having to look after kids and home educate them. These are all very difficult positions for people with no alternatives. And there are lots of those in the country who are actually enjoying the lockdown in the sense that, A, they might be on guaranteed incomes, they might be public sector workers, they're in good jobs, and they can, as you say, work from rather comfortable surroundings. But there are a hell of a lot out there who aren't and whose jobs are at risk and their livelihoods are at stake.
Absolutely right. And those are the very people that Boris needs to think about. And those are the very people, many of whom probably are responsible for giving him his 80-seat majority, that he needs to start thinking about.
Yes, and I think he is thinking about them. I mean, from what I hear, he would like to be able to act sooner rather than later. And of course, he's fully aware, as Rishi Sunak will be telling him every time they meet, that the economy is in a very serious way. Mm. One day when we stop thinking about COVID and hearing about COVID at every tick of the clock on the radio news, we will start looking at the price we're going to have to pay for this in terms of the cost is just gigantic. We're going to see real implications for the daily lives. I mean, everything from road repairs to major health service funding and so on. Where is this money going to come from once we've decided that we can get back to work and there's no jobs?
Yes, exactly right. And finally, Trevor, what are you making of the situation with the Labour Party at the moment? Because Keir Starmer, I think, generally, universally was thought to have had a pretty bad week last week. He made his blunder at Prime Minister's questions about he couldn't remember what he'd said about the European Medicine Agency. He then got involved in a bit of a punch-up, it would seem, figuratively speaking, with Boris after the after PMQs behind the Speaker's chair. And also a lot of people in the Labour Party saying, you know, he's not really what we thought.
No, and I think that this is coming home to roost for the Labour Party. But, you know, I'm no fan of Keir Starmer for a variety of reasons, not least his persecution of two dozen Sun journalists on a witch hunt, on which they are all cleared. So my starting point is that I'm not a fan. But on the other hand, for many people, he is actually a very plausible looking person who he's a QC. He's obviously intelligent. He is, in theory, this sort of person that the Labour Party would need in order to bring it back from the Corbynite days. And yet, it's not working. His own personal ratings are fine, but the ratings of the Labour Party are dismal in the circumstances. They should be miles ahead right now. And what I think is being revealed here is a terminal decline in the Labour Party itself. This bickering, squabbling ship is sinking. It's beyond salvaging. And I think that many senior Labour figures are now beginning to wonder what on earth they're going to do in order to create an opposition which is fit for purpose.
Yes, I think that's right, because they lost Scotland because they weren't careful enough about protecting it. They apparently have now lost the north of England and large parts of it. And they're left with a sort of rump of Putney, it would seem, and a bunch of Ramonas.
Yes, and that Red Wall vote, by the way, is not a group of Labour voters, ordinary members of the public who dearly wish they had a Labour Party to support. These are people who have given up on the Labour Party as it stands and have left, and they really want to see more of what Boris Johnson offered them in the general election, which made them vote for the Tories. Mm. They don't want to go back to Labour. They don't want a soft left style Tory party. They want a party that delivers jobs and prosperity to their region and to them and their families.
Yes. And they're only going to get that one way. Trevor, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Trevor Cavanagh, political columnist at The Sun, with a view on Boris Johnson that he wants to get us out of this, but he's being prevented from doing so by this rather odd collection of sage advisers, many of whom are not advising him on the basis of any medical knowledge, but are advising him on the basis of probabilities, of sort of, you know, psychological manoeuvrings and behavioural science. It doesn't make much sense to me.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
We're going to talk now to Robert Clark, Defence Research Fellow at the Henry Jackson Society, because there was an incredible story yesterday in the Times all about Chinese government and Chinese firms kind of getting involved in all sorts of research projects at universities in this country. Now, hundreds of academics are now under investigation as a result of a report which basically shows the Chinese sort of cultural influence into levels of academia in Britain. Robert, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, very well indeed. This is quite an extraordinary story. Tell us about it.
Sure. So, first of all, this is nothing new in that sense. What we've done is highlight specific key examples of the influence that China have within UK universities, research institutions, and associated industry partners. Mm. Now, this work builds on a lot of previous work done last year, both at Civitas and at the Henry Jackson Society. And crucially, what we've done is we've identified 107 relationships between UK universities and institutions and with Chinese military-linked either defence universities or arms manufacturers in China. And then what we've done with these relationships, we've actually managed to identify several key areas where research based in the UK is actually being exploited back in China and potentially have a great impact with the rise of Chinese militarization and their modernization programs for military.
Right. And if you say this has been going on for such a long time, why has it not really been highlighted before? What's the difference now, say, to it was two or three years ago?
Sure. So I think last year was really a turning point with a report I was involved with Civitas last year. And like I said, with the Henry Jackson Society themselves have done similar work. So last year was really a turning point. And I think now there's enough noise out there with these reports like the one we've done recently. And it highlights this strategic incoherence, really, that Britain have had. And this goes back to really Theresa May's government and the so-called golden era of UK-Chinese relations. And it's only really becoming apparent now, both the scale and the scope of how incoherent and a policy this is for UK national interests.
And it's a strange one, isn't it? Because the academics in question are under investigation for what they may have done to contribute to China getting weapons of mass destruction. But then it says, but they didn't do it knowingly.
No, sure. So there are several instances where, for example, the term weapons of mass destruction is quite lobbied around carelessly. And we've identified these key areas where that actually applies in UK research that's then used in China, potentially. We use the word inadvertently, for example, because there is no actual proof or link that the academics and the institutions in the UK have done this knowingly. They've acted in good faith, often looking for, crucial funding, which China are only too happy to provide. And we're not suggesting that the universities in the UK or the academics themselves in question have breached, sort of national laws and obviously sanctions regimes in place against China. But this is a much wider issue of the Chinese civil-military fusion strategy, where they will seek to... they will seek cooperation within civilian industries, and they will use that for their own military gain.
Yes. There's an interesting piece, a follow-up in the Mail today, I don't know if you've seen it, Influence for Sale, and they highlight a woman by the name of Ling Gi, who's got a PhD from Oxford and is Tencent's main representative in Europe. It turns out that Tencent, which I assume is a Chinese company, have now got their name on the Wycombe Chair of Physics at Oxford, and it's now called the Tencent Wycombe Chair.
Yeah, so interestingly, and I think this is a wider example of what's happening in some of the universities. 15, for example, Russell Group universities have been implicated. Now, what we've done with the universities themselves, we've actually we've given them enough time and scope to try and address these issues, and we've included that in the report. And we've actually, the online version is open for any more refutal and rebuttals from the universities themselves.
Right.
But there is it's not just the funding from the Chinese, which the case you've just highlighted shows. It's also the wider collaboration between academics and scientists in China and in the UK.
Yes.
For example, the several key joint cooperative events, particularly at Imperial College, where they have key Chinese scientists almost running these centres. So that alone is a worrying trend.
Certainly is, since Imperial College seems to have a direct line into Downing Street, because so many of the people on SAGE are from Imperial College. And in fact, an awful lot of what goes on at NervTag is run by Imperial College.
Yeah, I mean, Imperial College is one of the ones that's got several of these research institutions. Now, what we've looked at doesn't go towards health or implicate SAGE, for instance, at all. Mm. It is much more civilian science-based research, but then will be potentially getting exploited in China for the military.
Yes.
And we've identified that quite laboriously in several key examples.
And the Mail's got a picture of this woman, Ling Gi, with TV physicist Brian Cox. Look at the sky, is what he normally says.
Yeah, so with Brian Cox, certainly with Manchester, at Manchester University, they alone have two centres, one of which is still very much running. What we've done is... there's several key instances where there are these institutions in the UK where they may no longer be producing research, but some of them certainly are, even up until last year. And one of the centres at Manchester is one of them.
Mm. And what's the government said about your report? Because it's pretty damning, I would have thought, of their kind of security situation, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it's damning so much of the security situation. What we've tried to do is highlight recent this strategic incoherence, which, like I say, dates back to Theresa May's government. And hopefully what this report will do is actually shed a bit more light, not so much on the lack of UK security, but certainly the influence of China and sort of the wider Chinese strategic narrative of this civil-military fusion. And naturally, it leads to their, you know, they have a desire, obviously, to overtake the US militarily this decade. And it all feeds into this broader strategic context where the UK have been very slow to realise this. And hopefully this report will help to add to that debate.
Absolutely. Robert, it's a great report. It's well worth reading. Robert Clark, Defence Research Fellow at the Henry Jackson Society. You can find it on Twitter. We'll retweet it out, of course, as well. I was saying just the other day how ludicrous some of our institutions have now become, our seats of higher learning. Not only now have we got them full of lecturers who are telling our young people how to think, what to think and what not to think and what not to believe in, but we're also now finding out about the rather insidious reach of Chinese companies, about military and civilian sort of aims that they may have in this country. Surely this is worthy of a very big government investigation, isn't it?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, the snow's still falling, the gloom is descending, but, you know, we're feeling pretty optimistic here at the Independent Republican, Mike Graham, as ever. Let's talk to Matt Kelly, founder of The New European. Matt, a very good morning to you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. Very nice to speak to you. Now, we sort of caught up with each other the other day because we hadn't really spoken, seen each other much. No, I mean, I haven't really seen anyone much, to be honest, since last March, because we had a bit of a breeze, I suppose, through the summer. But how's the lockdown been for you, first of all? Let me ask you that.
It's been terrific, mate. I mean, you know how sociophobic I am. So
yes.
Yeah, the idea that I can bury myself in a room and just sort of observe the world on a screen is heaven.
Yes, but you see that you've just fulfilled another stereotype of one of these kind of, you know, rather well-off North London sort of champagne socialists who can sit home with his laptop and make as much money as he made before.
Well, I'm not making that much money, mate. In fact, I'm making a lot less now that I've taken the New European private.
Yes, tell us about that, because it was owned by a group called Archant, but they ran into a bit of trouble, didn't they?
Well, so I was working for Archant when I had the idea of the New European. And as you know, it was only meant to last for a few weeks, but it sort of grew a life of its own. And Archant, like all local media industries, is struggling. And just as an aside, I would really encourage people to, you know, do what they can to support their local newspapers, because they are seriously at danger of going out. And I promise people they will not realise how much they miss it until it's gone. You know, who is going to hold local councillors to account? Who is going to promote and be the champions of your community? It's the local media. And if they go, you're in big trouble. So anyway, Archant needed to change hands and were bought by a private equity company who talked to me about would I like to buy the New European, because they didn't see how it fitted in Archant's portfolio. Mm. And I said I would very much like to do that, and went to speak to a few people and very quickly got, I think we'll all agree, a quite illustrious band of investors together, and we took it off Archant's hands, and this is now the second week of ownership, and it feels great.
Yeah. Can you name who they are, or is that secret?
Yeah. No, I can. So we've got, and this will confirm most of your suspicions of the sort of the global Remain conspiracy.
Yes.
We've got Mark Thompson, the former BBC Director General and Chief Executive of the New York Times.
Yeah.
We've got Lionel Barber, who's until recently the editor-in-chief of the Financial Times, the FT. We've got Gavin O'Reilly, is chairman of the business. Gavin used to run the independent group of newspapers and very sort of experienced media operator. And then there's a host of others, including, you know, interestingly, a guy called Tavit Henricus, who is the founder of a billion-pound revenue business called TransferWise, which people use the whole world over to move money about. Mm. And Tavit's an Estonian who thinks that there's a need for, you know, more and more debate, more and more conversation about what does Europe become, what does Britain become. And, you know, we've got 14 people who just think it's a good thing to do, and they're putting their money where their mouth is.
No, I think it's absolutely great. And unlike some people who are on the other side of the political divide from me, who are already trying to shut down a TV station before it's actually got going, you know, I think the more debate, the better, really, because Europe has changed, hasn't it? I mean, as part of what has happened to the EU, you know, Britain has moved away from it. And I think there's even more reason now, if you're in the EU, to think about doing the same thing.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that, but I think definitely it's exposed flaws. You know, I think it's exposed flaws on both sides of the channel. I think, you know, but in particular, the vaccine crisis, yeah, I think, made a lot of people look at the European Union Commission and think, you a bunch of clowns. Mm. And, you know, I was one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the new European has never been afraid of sticking it to the European Commission when it needs to. Our belief has always just been that we are, even taking into account all of the flaws on both sides, we're better off at the table with those 27 nations than we are off the table. And I still think that's the case. But there's no question, and it's never been my position, that, you know, we're leaving a perfect institution. I think if I was the European Commission, I'd be looking at what's happening in the UK and saying, hang on a minute, we won't be alone here in seeing nations looking at how they've been like the speedboat, like they called us, around the vaccines,
yeah,
and saying, we want a piece of that. Well, I understand that. But I do think there's a way of combining much, much closer relationships. I don't like us to, and I'm not suggesting that this is behind the Brexit vote, but I don't like the sense that Britain is somehow so special that it can go alone, you know, and our kind of nationalism is something that needs to be protected. I don't think it does. I'm quite confident in what Britain means, and I think it's an amazing country. But I do think we can show a lot to Europe, and Europe can show a lot to us as well.
Yeah, of course. The other interesting thing that's happened since the leaving of the European Union is concerned is that Britain itself is now under scrutiny more, because, of course, we've got Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP arguing, yeah, and agitating for independence. They seem to, yeah, think that they would be better off inside the EU. I don't think that'll ever happen, do you?
Well, I mean, there's certainly no guarantee that if they dropped out of the United Kingdom, they'd be automatically accepted back into the European Union. No, I do not, to answer your question. You know, I think the United Kingdom is a very powerful institution, and it's very it is a very deep history and cultural connection that it almost seems ridiculous to be even talking about breaking up with the United Kingdom, especially, I mean, put Northern Ireland to one side, because that is more complicated and it's more kind of the history there is different.
Yeah.
But the history with Scotland and Wales, the idea that, you know, in our lifetime, we're talking about them becoming separate nations. Well, if you'd have had that conversation with me when I was 15 years old, you'd have laughed it out of the classroom. But now it's a real conversation.
Yeah, but there's a lot of bizarre conversations going on at the moment, aren't there, that you never thought you would ever be having? Because, I mean, the thing, yeah, about what I think the EU vaccine crisis has shown is that a lot of individual European countries are also very proud nations on their own, and they look at what's going on in Brussels, and they look at who's running the Commission itself, and they're not very smart. They're not very good at what they, yeah, do.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. I was speaking to a very influential German journalist who's going to join the New European as a columnist. And because that's part of the New European's mandate, I think, is to try and have Europeans explaining the thinking behind some of these decisions. Mm. You know, why does Germany act the way it does? Why does France and Macron say the things he does? Why do the European Commission fall into these behaviours? And this German lady, Tanne Koch, was saying to me, you know, there's definitely an appetite for a paper like the New European in Germany. But actually what Germany needs is the opposite of the New European. Mm. They need something to show, you know, to be a bit more skeptical about the New European. And I think that's probably fair enough. You know, there's no point getting carried away in some sentimental, you know, vision of a federal Europe where everybody is the same, but we all speak different languages and we've all got different industries and we've all got different backgrounds. We're not the United States of Europe and we never will be. But I think you're absolutely right in the sense that there are countries within the European Union who are thinking maybe we should be a little bit more skeptical. But for me, the answer isn't, oh, leave the European Union. The answer is change the European Union. I still think it's a great project and it's got a long way to go.
But that was an argument that a lot of British politicians used, wasn't it? Many, many years and many, many decades ago when they said, you know, it's better to be inside it, having a seat at the table, making changes to it. But I don't want to keep using the vaccine crisis as the only example, but it really showed that these people are pretty sort of quick to punish those that don't do what they want, who are pretty quick. I mean, the idea that they suddenly decided that after arguing that we could never put a border down through the middle of Ireland and they decided they could. I mean, it's quite extraordinary what they did. And, and they looked kind of petulant. They looked inexperienced. And frankly, they just looked amateurish.
People who are watching the stream, they can see over my shoulder, this is the current issue of the new European.
I thought that was maybe the back page about Liverpool.
that's even worse. It is a crisis for the European Union. And the thing is, I wouldn't. The tragedy of what happened over the vaccine was that it affirmed everybody's worst views. You know, and if you were a hardcore Brexiteer, then you sat back and you said, look, we were right all along. There are a bunch of bullies and they're, this is not behaviour Britain should be part of. I would say, you know, put it in perspective. It was if you and I were sitting in the pub, I'd have stronger language. It was an error, you know, and it was anomalous. But I do think it did expose a kind of flakiness and a weakness and an insecurity, perhaps, at the top of the European Commission.
And what do you think is going to happen, for example, with the French elections? Because if Macron loses, which he may or may not do, it's a bit too early to say and a bit too close to call, perhaps. But I think if Marine Le Pen gets in, that's going to be a massive, building block, isn't it, for France to leave it?
Well, yes. I mean, for me, that would be tragic. I mean, you've always got to be careful about not patronising a constituency of voters, which, you know, was a mistake we all fell into in 2016, I think, or making assumptions about what lies behind that vote. But for me, somebody as far right as Marine Le Pen gets into the Elysee, then that's bad news for Europe. It may be a killer blow for the European Union over time. I don't know.
Yeah. And is your position as the newspaper, the New European, all about rejoining or is it just about continuing the conversation?
No, I think... we're not the Rejoiners Gazette. Let me put it this way. I think if we do rejoin the European Union, it's got to be a very different European Union and it will take a long time to get there. I think in the meantime, we've all now got to look forward and we've got to be progressive and constructive. And I'm fed up, and I'm sure all of your listeners are, I'm fed up whining about 2016 or certain elements of the iniquity of the vote and who lied. And I mean, the point is, it's gone, man. That bird has flown. We've got to look forward now. And what I'd like the New European to be, its editorial position, is to look for how we can build bridges that are constructive and helpful with Europe, to stop being so kind of... shouty and maybe stop being quite so partisan so that we can engage people in a conversation. I still very much believe in the European Union as a project, but there's no point me just saying you're wrong or you got lied to. We've now got to look forward and say, okay, let's deal in specifics. Let's talk about how can the NHS be better by looking perhaps at other healthcare institutions across Europe? How can we have a fairer democracy in this country by perhaps having proportional representation so that when the Green Party get a million votes, they don't just get one MP? You know, I think these kind of things, now is a time for Britain, I think, both for Brexit and for the COVID crisis. Now is a time for us to take stock and to think about big answers to very big questions that have plagued us for decades, all my lifetime. And I think, you know, with this kind of bold, new, adventurous spirit that the Brexiteers have called for, well, let's engage everybody and try and be as constructive as possible for everybody in this country, not just 52% or 48%. Let's move forward as an adventurous nation.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And also in terms of trade with Europe and all of that, you know, we want to get the best deal that we can, but there's no need or reason for that to become a sort of, you know, a friends or enemies conversation. It should just be we cooperate with one another in the best way that helps both parties, really. And you can do individual deals with individual countries. There's no reason you can't, except for the fact that the European Union won't let you.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, and also the WTO. There are global protocols in place that are there to protect fairness and so that you can't carve up industries and carve up mates and have separate rules for separate people. But, you know, I mean, it's hard to say to the European Union, you should just bend over to accommodate the UK, because it was the UK that instigated this crisis, and I think the obligation is on the UK to show that all the promises and the pledges that we made, that we can at least, you know, do our very best to make them come true. I was a bit worried when I saw, you know, the UK is now applying to be a member of this Pacific trading bloc. Last time I looked on a map, you know, we are nowhere near the Pacific Ocean. So, you know,
apparently there's some island in it though that we still own. It hasn't been stripped from us.
Right.
So apparently that gives us, if you need, you apparently don't actually need, physical presence in it.
But the idea that, and I'm not saying this is the case, but if it was the case that we were, you know, swapping trade with 27 nations, the nearest of which is 13 miles away, for trade with Peru, makes me wonder about the sanity of the, you know, the lack of logic there. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I think so far it's going pretty well. I mean, I know that we can probably argue about that all day, but I'm glad to see there's still things that we disagree about, Matt, as well. I'm not going to get too reasonable here. But tell us about the project as well a little bit, because I'm interested in the future of newspapers, as you are, obviously, and the future of all media, because it has changed an awful lot since you and I both worked together back in the Daily Mirror. But what about, is most of your sale now actual papers, or is it online?
No. It's still 95% is something you can hold in your hand and get posted through. And our subscribers are growing terrifically. The paper, you know, I'd just like to say, to get my kind of hype in, the paper is not just about Brexit. You know, in fact, it's anything, but it's become very broad. It's got that European, liberal, progressive feel about it. But I like to think that it's grounded in common sense in the centre, and there'd actually be a lot of ideas there that, you know, lots of different people would find themselves surprised to agree with. And it's got loads of European culture stuff. So it's, my plan is that we continue to grow the newspaper. I think the idea of being a niche these days is good. You know, I think the broader you are, the harder it is in media to kind of really make a compelling business model. So I'm not concerned about being in a niche. In fact, the Americans, who pronounce it "nick," have got a phrase that the riches are in the niches. And, you know, I think that's, there's a lot to be said for that. But I think, you know, there's a market for us over, I think Europe is very interested in what's happening in the UK. And a lot of European media people I speak to are surprised, actually, to hear that it's not everybody's kind of, you know, raving Brexiteer. And, you know, they've got the impression that Farage, for instance, who's fallen off the radar for me, that Nigel Farage is kind of moving the conversation along. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think both sides have simmered down a bit. And, you know, perhaps there are people who these days would have considered themselves traditional Labour voters 30 years ago or traditional Tories 30 years ago. And now they're not quite so sure, and they're more interested in this idea of, can we bring about radical change from the centre, you know, where stuff gets done, rather than the dogma on either side of the political spectrum.
I think there's still a hangover, though, from the whole situation with what Nigel Farage managed to achieve, because he did, despite the fact that you probably would never give him credit for it, he did achieve what he wanted to achieve, which was to get Britain out of the European Union. And I think COVID has obviously tainted everything, because imagine if we didn't have COVID, we'd be talking about Brexit probably non-stop at the moment, because the people who would want it to be going wrong or would want to report on it going wrong would be doing that, and those of us who wanted it to be a success would be doing that. And he hasn't really fallen off the radar. I mean, he's on Talk Radio quite a bit, actually. And he's writing a column in the Telegraph quite regularly. Yeah. And of course, we've got the May elections coming up, and it may well be that the Reform UK party does quite well.
It may be. But what I mean is that, you know, 2 years ago, whenever Nigel Farage wanted to be at the centre of the conversation, he was there. And he hasn't been lately, I would suggest. Mm. But, I think what we'll see, and I think I was listening to Piers Morgan talking to Chris Evans on Chris Evans's show, and you know, you and I both know Piers very well, and to hear Piers talking about it's time for moderate language and not to inflame situations, you know, quite ring true.
Not quite, but, no.
You know, if Piers,
he had a half an hour argument with me.
Yeah, sure. But if Piers can come to that conclusion, I think the rest of us can. And I'd really like, I think people want to stop. You know, there's always room for good old ranty polemics and good old ranty arguments. But at the end of the day, I do think people want this country to move forward, and we've all got to agree on ways to do
it. I definitely don't want to go back to those days when I used to trudge down to College Green every day, marching past the phalanx of people with European Union flags and that moron with the loud hailer and a lot of other people with the Union Jack, all on different sides of the road shouting at each other, actually arguing with each other in the street. And I'm going, what are you doing? You know?
I mean, and the weird thing is that we all sort of sympathise with one side or the other, depending on what our political flavour was. And I think you're right. You look back at that and it just looks, A, it looks really petty and pathetic. And B, it just looks like pointless. You know, what was the point of streaming at people you didn't like as they were stood on a Sky News podium being interviewed?
And you didn't even not like them. You just didn't like what they were saying. I mean, it was bizarre.
That's right.
You know, very bizarre.
Right. I'll tell you one thing, which I recommend to everybody, is get off social media and start having proper conversations and read newspapers to get your ideas. Good ideas.
Even Donald Trump apparently has even said he's a lot happier having given it up.
Yeah. Honestly, I'll tell you what, mate, I came off it and I've got about 2 hours a day back of my life. But I think I'm not exaggerating here or trying to make a silly point. Your positivity levels are so much better away from Twitter than because you're just not bombarded by stuff that's in your face and aggravating you all the time. Get off Twitter.
All right, Matt, listen, you've become far too reasonable. We're never having you on again. That's great. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Matt Kelly, founder of the New European, and a far more reasonable man now that we've left the European Union and that he's no longer on social media.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
Let's say a very good afternoon to Dr. Lawrence Gurlis. Lawrence, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Mike. Yes, good.
Excellent. I'm going to start with my usual question to you. How's the traffic flow in your surgery? How's the GP business doing this week?
Well, whereas in January we were seeing people with COVID, positive COVID test, a new Kent variant, it's gone quiet. I can't remember the last time I've seen a positive case. I have to upload my results to Public Health England, and we're just not seeing the positives now. It really is on the way out, which is great on the front line. I think it's an achievement. And you've mentioned the vaccination campaign. I think it's really starting. You know, having started in December, it's really starting to affect the numbers and bringing them down. And as we can see, bringing the death rate down, we await the Tuesday figures, which are always the worst of the week. But if they're not too bad today, I shall feel greatly encouraged.
Yes, I mean, I'm seeing figures from some parts of the country where the reduction is as much as they're down to sort of 10% of what they were around about, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, no, it's come down very quickly. I mean, we've talked about lockdown. Lockdown is having an effect. As we've said before, lockdown should eradicate the virus completely. It doesn't. So I don't actually believe full lockdown works. I think sensible measures and social distancing and masks help. But the severity of this lockdown combined with the vaccination campaign, the fact that we're hopefully coming out of winter, although it's a very cold week, all of those combined to bring the numbers down. And this will continue. I hope by February 22nd, when the Prime Minister gives us his roadmap, he can be look at the figures and be very optimistic.
Yes, well, let's hope so, because I was saying, and I've now said it twice on the show, this yesterday's briefing with Jonathan Van Tam, as Matt Hancock was talking about how high the percentages of people who have been vaccinated, 95% of, I think, 80-year-olds or over 70-year-olds and that kind of thing. I kept waiting for the next bit, which was going to say, and as a result, we can announce that something or other was going to be open. But they still haven't quite reached that point, have they?
No, we'll find out on 22nd. I'm hoping that the Prime Minister defies the advice of the scientists and takes a bold move and starts to release things sooner rather than later. I believe the schools will go back on March the 8th, and I think that is a good signal for other things like shops, like some pubs and restaurants, other leisure facilities. But that, you know, it's not up to me. Speaking as a clinician, I would feel it is perfectly safe to do that as long as we're sensible.
Yes. I mean, what's interesting to me as well, and I guess we'd have to be careful because, I mean, I've certainly said it before, back in the summer, back end of sort of August and early September of last year, that it seemed to have disappeared altogether. There didn't seem to be much trace of the virus any longer in large parts of the country. But then, of course, it came back in this new form, partly because of the reopening of universities and schools and all of that. And suddenly we were back in it, back in sort of November. So, I mean, are you confident that if this is the end of it, that it won't be back?
I am confident, yes, because it's a different time of year, spring rather than autumn. We know last spring was bad, but that's an entirely different situation. Mm. You're talking about 12 million people vaccinated. I would estimate a similar number have got natural immunity from the infection. I mean, the official numbers are 3 million or such, but I know, we all know, that a lot of people have been positive without ever being tested, without ever being reported, or some people have got immunity without even knowing that they've been that ill. So we're talking about getting on for half of the country very soon are going to be protected against this virus. And important to point out, you talk about the South Africa variant. I've not heard a single report of anyone who had COVID back in March getting sick again. I've not heard of a hospital doctor or nurse who was sick back in March who's now gone down with the South African variant or even the Kent variant. So to question the efficacy of the vaccines when it does appear that immunity protects you against all types of COVID-19 is nonsense. You know, the vaccines work, including the AstraZeneca one. I don't want people going out refusing them. I'm distressed to hear that in Hackney, the vaccine centres are closing early through lack of demand. That is simply not acceptable. We've all got to go out and get vaccinated.
Yes, I think that's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, I heard an amazing conversation on a radio show the other day about somebody who said that there were some nurses that he had been talking to who were from a black and ethnic minority backgrounds who were saying that they weren't going to take the vaccine because their pastor had told them not to.
It's a real challenge. It's ridiculous, yes. And it's a real challenge because you're talking about a group of people who do worse with COVID, who really should get vaccinated. I hope we can overcome that urgently because we don't want a reservoir of people who are going to continue to get sick. That would be very unfortunate.
It would
indeed
be very counterproductive as well in particular parts of the country. And what I find interesting as well, though, of course, Lawrence, is that the politicians are telling us, and so are the scientific advisers, that we will continue to have variants because that's what the virus does. So if you're saying that we should be glad that we've got the vaccine, I think that's absolutely right. Because if you did have to tweak it, you've got it already. It's not like you have to invent something.
Yeah, but at this stage, there's no reason to suggest we have to change the vaccine. Okay, if they're going to change the vaccine, fine. I don't think we're going to need annual vaccinations. We might want to add something to the annual flu jab. All that I've seen is this vaccine works, and it works against all variants, and even a single dose works. And we can see that in the way the numbers are coming down. And that's my personal experience looking at the patients I've seen, the patients have been vaccinated. I've not seen a single person who has been vaccinated once, then go on to get COVID.
Yes. And I mean, it has been a remarkable effort by all concerned, and there's no reason to think that that won't be continue to be the case. But, you know, as far as the business, the day-to-day business that you're seeing, are you able to say as a GP now to people, you know, come and see us if you've got something wrong with your leg, come and see us if you've got, a hip problem, a backache, all that sort of thing? Are you able to now sort of increase your capacity, if you like?
Yeah, well, I am. We've never closed. We've carried on seeing people face-to-face all the way through in our sector. We're in a private clinic. Mm. Having said that, it's very quiet at the moment. The weather is bad. February is generally a pretty quiet month for various reasons anyway. Mm. We were mainly doing PCR tests for people travelling abroad, and, of course, that's ground to a halt.
Yes.
But, yes, we do have people with serious medical conditions, and we are getting them secondary care, hospital care. We can do that, but by and large, a lot of the health service has still ground to a halt, and people are not being able to access healthcare in the way that they hoped they could.
No, I mean, I was looking at a story from the Telegraph earlier on today in which it said that as a result of the initial lockdown, there was something like 2/3 of people who died as a result of not being able to get medical treatment from things other than COVID than as many died of COVID.
Yeah, I mean, it's always very difficult to put a number on these things. There's no doubt from my experience that people cannot get referrals to specialists in the health service. A lot of people are still having trouble getting in to see their GP. They're having video and phone consultations, which are not satisfactory if you can't examine the patient. And investigations, scans, x-rays, biopsies, all of that sort of thing, they're not happening. And it has to be inevitable. I know of a handful of cases of people done very badly because they couldn't get hospital care. Mm. But there must be thousands of cases around the country. It's very sad. All the more reason why we should be opening things up soon.
Mm, absolutely. Because looking around as well, and I know that not every part of the country is the same, but when we talk about the success of the lockdown combined with the vaccinations and combined with the numbers of people who have already had the disease, you know, it hasn't been a lockdown which has been what I would call completely and utterly kind of meaning that nothing was going on. There was an awful lot of people driving around, an awful lot of people still going to work, an awful lot of people out and about. So, you know, that's good news in a way, because it means that once things do open up, hopefully it doesn't absolutely change it overnight.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it does beg the question, what's the point of the lockdown anyway? We, you know, there's every good reason for easing it a bit now.
Yeah.
If people are still going to work, you're right, the roads are still very busy. Parking in London is difficult, but I think that's because some people are avoiding public transport.
Yes.
But you're right, it hasn't ground to a halt, and the numbers are coming down. So that is kind of proof that we're doing okay and that we can think about easing the lockdown in so many different ways. I accept it has to be gradual, but, you know, this idea that we'll still be in some form of restrictions by the summer, surely that's a nonsense.
Yes, well, it should be, shouldn't it? Because presumably, once we get into March, there will be people under 50 getting the vaccination, won't there?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. And all the vulnerable people would have been vaccinated and protected. The hospital admissions and death rates will come down. There's an argument that the under 50s, if they develop herd immunity, that's not a bad thing if we let them out of lockdown. People that are talking about sporting events and so on, mass gatherings, I think, are probably the last thing on the list. But as far as I'm concerned, pretty much everything else should be opened up March at the latest. I don't see why we'd have to wait till Easter for these things to happen.
Right. And I mean, later on today, we think Matt Hancock's going to be announcing a whole bunch of changes to the travel sort of rules as such, and they're going to be telling us about how this hotel quarantine is going to work, although I'm slightly dubious that they haven't yet apparently hired any hotel chains to provide all these rooms. I'm not sure if this is going to be one of those policies that gets talked about but never actually done.
Well, I'm utterly confused by this travel thing. I'm waiting for the announcement, which will come in about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But I woke up this morning to emails from patients saying, do you do these tests at 2 and 8 days? And I had to look up to see what they're talking about.
Right.
Now, this is a plan that everyone travelling into the UK, apart from having a PCR COVID test before they travel, must also have a test on day 2 and day 8 after they land. and it's also a PCR test. Now, I don't know how this works because we're doing these tests for people. Presumably, they can't come into my clinic on day two. I mean, we are seeing people on day five for tests to release. We're on the official government list for test release, but I'm not sure I want to see people 2 days after they've arrived from certain countries.
No.
So presumably that's a postal test, number one. Secondly, it's mandatory. So are people going to buy the test, be forced to buy the test at the airport? Because as far as I can see, that's the only way you can make it work. If you say to Joe Bloggs, OK, come into the country, but you've got to do a test of 2 days and 8 days, he's going to go home. Is he going to phone up my clinic and buy two tests at a cost of £300, £400? I don't think he is.
Well, not if he's having to waste all the rest of his money in a hotel that he's been forced to stay at. But, I mean, this is the other thing, right? I was under the impression they were going to say that the test will be presented to the people arriving at the airport and they'll have to take the test at the airport. But if they're already requiring a negative test before you get on the plane, I mean, that's just going to cause massive hold-ups, isn't it?
Look, I think, again, it's too little too late. We should have done things about travel a long time ago. But the problem now is that we're doing so much better than the other countries in terms of vaccinations that they don't want to throw away the advantage we've got. So it's right to be strict about travelling. But this day two, day eight thing doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm not sure how it's going to be policed. I mean, as I said, we're doing test to release. I'm not sure that anyone is checking up on patients who say they've had a test at day five. In theory, someone should be phoning our clinic and saying, is it true that Joe Bloggs had a test on day five? That doesn't happen. Is that going to happen for the people having tests at day two and day eight? There's another group of people from certain countries that won't be able to go home. Those are the quarantine ones. You come from South Africa. I don't know if you're allowed to travel from South Africa, but if you're on the red list, those are the ones that go into quarantine. Those won't get these tests. We're talking about anyone from Spain, France, or any other country coming into the country from this date that Matt Hancock's going to say will have to have three tests, one before they travel, one at day two and one at day eight, if they haven't already done test to release at day five, which is incredibly confusing for everyone.
Well, it is. And also, if you're planning on avoiding that scenario because it only applies to people coming from certain countries, there's a pretty good chance you might try and avoid it by going via a different country, isn't it?
Well, my understanding is that this is for everyone. Mm. I don't think there is any country.
Oh, really? Okay.
My understanding is for everyone traveling to the UK. There is the red list, and I think those are people that have to quarantine for 10 days. And there's the other list where people can do test release of 5 days, but they also have to do this day two, day eight thing.
Right.
But we'll find out from Matt Hancock soon. My understanding is that is anyone. And can you imagine how that's going to affect people travelling, which may be a good thing,
yes.
But I think travelling will just stop. I think it will literally just stop. And then the next question is, how long is this going to be in place for? Because obviously half term, well, no one's going to be going away February half term, but is this going to go on till Easter? We simply don't know.
Right. Well, let's see whether he does actually explain himself today, as you say, in the next half an hour or so. But I mean, I had a strange thing happen at the weekend where a plane flew over the house. And we stuck up that, you put the app to find out which plane it is, where it's coming from and all that. And according to the app, the plane was a BA flight from Johannesburg. And we're going, well, what's that all about then? Now, I don't know whether it was, if they'd got that wrong, or whether it was an empty plane, or whether it maybe just had cargo because there was no passengers. But, I mean, it just seemed a bit odd that it doesn't matter what you're talking about. If you're flying from Joburg to London, you've still got crew who shouldn't be doing that, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, this has been going on for a long time, as you know, Mike, and the pictures we've seen of people queuing up at immigration at Heathrow hotels. So people in going holiday. I mean, I'm still furious about what's happening in December, the number of people going away at Christmas. I've talked to you before that we were doing literally thousands of tests for people leaving the country at Christmas for holidays and coming back. And really no one addressed that issue. Mm. So they've done it too late, but it's probably the right thing to do for a short time. I mean, let's do it for a short time, but come on, by this time next month, we've got to release people a little bit.
Yes, I think that's what we have to do. Dr. Lawrence Gurlis, as ever, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. GP at Same Day Doctor, very much of the opinion, as I am, that it is surely time, if all of the vaccination programs are running as well as they are, if all of the infection rates are down as much as they are, as much as 10% now of what they were at their height back in January, you know, down from over 1,000 to 10 to 100 in some cases in certain parts of the country, you know, surely the next conversation is about what happens with people who need either to get their kids back to school or their businesses back up and running, opening up the economy, that kind of thing. It must be happening soon.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.